Of Talking Cricket with Real Sport. I am your host, cricket editor Daniel Lang. Today I'm joined by Bowden Nicholson and Thomas Slipinchewski, the sub-editor of the cricket section at Real Sport. We're going to talk a little bit of Ashes, talk a little bit of cricket, and talk a little bit about the first test at the Gabba. First of all, Tom, welcome on board. This will be your first podcast here at Real Sport.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. And Bowden, you're a seasoned veteran by now with some of the league podcasts we've done.
Yes, but very much looking forward to my first chance to talk some cricket. Let's get into it.
I'm very much looking forward to that. Probably not as much as I'm looking forward to the first test, which is in less than a week now. It's Saturday morning here in Australia. We're getting ready for a Thursday morning start at the Gabba. It's the big one. The Ashes is the series that we all wait for. It's the one we mark out years in advance. All the other tests are great. Having India here, having Pakistan here, having Sri Lanka here, touring the subcontinent is great, but the Ashes is really where it starts. And I'm assuming a lot of that history is going to be a big selling point for yourself, Bo, coming into this week.
Well, absolutely. And the actual very interesting thing is that across all the series in the history of the Ashes, we are actually drawn for the amount of series won. So it's 32 series each with five drawn series, four of which were retained by Australia. So in a sense, Australia is up. But if you want to be really technical, 32 series wins each. So we're coming into our 70th series, all locked and ready to see who is the greatest Ashes team in history, Australia or England. Time will tell.
So that probably sums it up, doesn't it? Over all these years and all these series and the changing of the guards from your WG Graces to Don Bradmans through to Ricky Ponnings and Freddie Flintoffs. Well, despite all that, it's still neck and neck, which is pretty crazy. Tom, I'm assuming as an Englishman, you're going to have some late nights, some early mornings. It'll be a bit of a battle for you, but it should be an interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely. I've already tried to think about how the best way of managing the sleep is. But I'm looking forward to it, and I'll find a way to do it.
Yeah, some of my best memories. Even you think 05, I would have been 16, and obviously a great tight series, but one that England won. But staying up all night, I think that was the year that SBS had it here in Australia randomly. The coverage was different. It was late nights. You're sitting up, you're sort of half asleep, and then a wicket falls or someone crunches a couple of big boundaries. It's the Ashes sort of brings out those moments, and obviously coming into this one, England hold the Ashes from their series win in 2015. Australia, the Return the Urn campaign again. Bo, the first test at the Gabba, which is obviously the one that's going to be coming up. We've had a 13-man squad name for Australia. We may as well just get straight into the nitty gritty. Right off the bat, Cameron Bancroft is probably going to open the batting with David Warner. Does he deserve to be there?
Short answer is yes. Cameron Bancroft was quite unlucky a few years ago where he was in top form as a 21-year-old. He was picked to tour Bangladesh, but unfortunately because of security concerns, that tour was cancelled, and by the time the home summer had come around, it was elected that they would go with someone else instead. So he'd never got his chance to debut for Australia. And basically at the start of the Sheffield, the JLT Shield, now as it's called in Australia, three matches ago, the selectors said that there were spots open and whoever knocks the door down is going to get in. And with, you know, a recent score of 228 not out, two half centuries against a test strength New South Wales attack, and only being 24 years old, very technically sound, gun close infielder, it's pretty hard to deny that he has actually knocked that door off the hinges. So I'd say he's definitely earned his spot. He's a born opener. So unfortunately, that meant that either Dave Warner, the vice captain, who had an amazing series in Bangladesh, or Matt Renshaw, another born opener, another promising player, were going to miss out, and that's been Matt Renshaw.
You don't think Cameron Bancroft could have dropped into the middle order in replace of, say, I don't know, picking someone at random, Sean Marsh?
I actually subscribe to the theory that a number six batsman should be someone that's very accomplished at accelerating a run rate, at managing a tail, at rotating strike, and at batting very technically sound. Now, we know that Bancroft is technically sound. We're not sure about his ability to accelerate a run rate, to manage a tail. This is a guy that's a new ball specialist, and obviously a number six can encounter a second new ball fairly regularly. But I prefer someone that has experience batting in limited overs, in those middle overs where you're rotating at four or five runs and over. Someone like a Sean Marsh, a George Bailey, a Callum Ferguson. I kind of see those people as better candidates for a number six role on the test side.
Tom, you've been... In the lead up to the series, you've been pretty steadfast that England have a better chance than we've sort of given you credit for. We've been pretty dismissive of England's chances down here. But does the Australian squad announcement, does that make you more confident? Does it change your thinking leading into the series?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, looking at the Bancroft inclusion, my initial thoughts were I kind of looked at Matt Renshaw, and I know he's not had the best few games, but in terms of his test career itself, he's actually had, in my opinion, he's had a very good start to his career. He's had a very challenging start to his career if you consider where he's actually been, and the fact that they've dropped him makes, to me, I automatically question, you know, are the selectors saying that they made a mistake in selecting him in the first place, you know, and I didn't know that the background of Bancroft in terms of him being selected for Bangladesh, but my initial thoughts were, you know, if I know hindsight's a wonderful thing, but if the Australian selectors now think that Renshaw isn't the man, you know, where did Bancroft fit into this when Renshaw was selected initially? Because you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Renshaw was actually selected when he was quite inexperienced as an opener, I questioned that in my mind. And also, we've had the pleasure of having Cameron Bancroft play in England too, and he's not, in my opinion, he's a solid opener, as Bo said, but he doesn't set the world on fire. I've got his stats in front of me. He only scored the 100 this season playing for Gloucester, and it was also in the second division as well. Now, I know it's totally different conditions, but I certainly don't feel that the English bowlers will worry so much. Also, I think it's got the chance of putting the cat amongst the pigeons as well, in terms of if for instance, Bancroft doesn't get off to the best of starts, and for instance, Renshaw goes and scores a few runs in domestic cricket, you know, this will be seen as a knee-jerk reaction to Renshaw just not having the best of starts to the season. That's my initial thoughts. On that.
Yeah, look, it's hard to disagree. It, to me, it seems like the selectors aren't particularly sure what they want to do. They threw Renshaw in the heat of the moment. Now, I mean, he's averaged over 10 tests. He's only played 27 first-class games, 10 of which have been test matches. He's got that 184 against Pakistan at the SCG, which was a huge knock in some pretty trying conditions. It was a huge knock.
Yeah.
Overall, 10 tests, little over 600 runs at an average of 36. It's not spectacular, but when you break it apart and see that six of those 10 tests were played in the subcontinent, four in Absolutely. India and two in Bangladesh, in some sides that copped some pretty handy beatings and had that draw in Bangladesh and certainly struggled with the conditions on the subcontinent, I thought he was one of the standout performers with the bat.
Absolutely.
So it does surprise me. And for me, I mean... one of our other cricket writers, Miles Steadman, made the point that he's one of only two Australian batsmen ever to have gone into the 180s before they turned 21. The other one was in, I think it was 1898. Glenn Hill. Yeah. So it's not an easy feat. So I don't mind the inclusion of Bancroft. I thought he's probably a bit more adaptable in terms of looking at someone to slot into the middle order, whereas Renshaw, I thought, has provided that that foil to David Warner at the top of the order a little bit, in much the same way that Australia tried to achieve with Shane Watson, Ed Gow and Chris Rogers. This is almost odd couple at the top, which has sort of been the go-to. But, you know, it is done. The other, it's probably not the biggest question mark on selection. The biggest question mark for mine, and I'll be interested to hear your opinion on this, both guys, is Tim Payne with the gloves. Bo, where did he come from? He was nearly retired not so long ago.
Yeah, it's look, I'm a little bit of a Tim Payne fan. I liked what he did in the Australian side, you know, all those years ago before that unfortunate finger injury that just kept recurring after a charity match. He is definitely a talent. I love watching him bat. He hits a ball hard, clean, through the offside. Reminds me a little bit of Brad Haddin in that way. And his glove work is pure. There's no doubt about it. But this is an odd one. Like, it is a strange decision. I mean, this guy in the last few seasons has averaged less than 20 with the stick. He's barely kept in that time. They've been giving the gloves to, you know, Ben Dunk, Jake Doran. Now they've got Matt Wade there. He's only played the one match of JLT Shield this season, where he scored a duck and 71 not out and fielded at first slip. Aside from that, he played for the CA 11 against England a couple of matches ago, made a 50, took a few catches, and he is the current 2020 international keeper for Australia. But this is an odd one. I think to be honest, Tim Payne should not be picked. He may well do well, but he should not have been picked. It sort of makes a little bit of a joke of the whole process, and if anything, it sheds a light on the fact that Australian keeping stocks are just pretty bloody ordinary at the moment. You know, Chris Hartley retires last year, and you've got to think that maybe he called it a season early because he would have been a front runner had he been available.
Yeah, look, it's hard to argue. I know Byron Coverdale made that same point on Twitter very quickly after the announcement. For me, I think the most illuminating point on that is that Darren Lehman, the coach of the Australian side, has a more recent first-class 100 in Australia than Tim Payne, which both over a decade ago, back in 2006. Tom, from your perspective, this is not the sort of selection that's going to strike any fear into the English?
Yeah. See, I totally agree with both of you. I know he scored runs against England, I think it was last week, but absolutely, that Australia can do far better than. I'm not saying Tim Payne's not a good batsman. I think he's actually a very good white ball batsman, and I love watching him in the Big Bash. But you know, just to use an example, for instance, so is Joss Butler, and he's a great keeper too, but he's an absolutely appalling Test batsman. And I think with having Tim Payne in at seven, that has the potential to really create a long tail, particularly if a few early wickets have been lost. And particularly, I know we'll come on to this afterwards possibly, but you know, in the day-night Test match when, you know, Jimmy Anderson's potentially firing and Chris Wokes is potentially firing, and a few early wickets go, and then you've got Tim Payne coming in. Yeah, I can't imagine Australia going to be full of confidence.
As you said, Bo. Sorry, go ahead, Bo.
I was just going to say, that's a really good point. And one thing that I would also question is the fact that he has not kept very much in recent years, especially in four-day cricket. And wicket-keeping is one of those sort of positions where if you haven't kept a lot recently and all of a sudden a five-day Test match, you might be out there for, let's call it 200 overs plus across 5 days, it's an endurance thing as well. Like, will Tim Payne have the endurance to keep at a quality standard and then bat with little to no practice in the last few seasons? It's a baffling decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to add to that, someone, you know, drop someone like Alistair Cook at your peril. I know he hasn't been in the best of forms, but and he will give you a chance early on. But as everyone knows, you know, if you drop Alistair Cook on, you know, single figures, he's got the potential to go on and get a huge score. And so I think wicket keeping is, it's absolutely imperative to have a, you know, a good quality keeper. And it, as Bo just said, you know, if he hasn't kept that much recently, it could potentially be, you know, there could potentially be quite a big issue there.
I think chances are going to be at a premium as well, particularly early on, as you mentioned, sort of Cook and guys like Joe Root. If you can put some pressure on that English top order, I think there's some struggles there. But if they get away with a couple of early opportunities and get a chance to get a start, then it could certainly make for a tough day at the office for the Aussie bowlers. For mine, Bo said it best when he said it shines a light on the lack of alternative options in the keeping stocks. You know, Matthew Wade's been dropped. I don't think there's too many people that were upset about that. He seems like a great guy. I'll say that. He seems like a genuinely nice guy. His glove work, he will sometimes do the spectacular, but his ball-to-ball glove work is not up to scratch, and his batting is not test level batting. Let's be honest, we'll call it what it is. Peter Neville, in terms of Wade, better gloveman. Probably hasn't shown that he's a better batsman at that level either, whereas guys like Alex Carey, probably a little bit young, a little bit inexperienced, but was certainly in the mix, and someone else who could wear the gloves would have been Cameron Bancroft. So it's certainly, there's some names there, but no one's really bashing the door down. So I guess selectors felt like they had to think outside the box almost.
Yeah, and they just went with the most pure gloveman they could think of. And Tim Payne has a reputation for being the best gloveman in Australia. So that's the rationale behind their decision. I'm just not sure if it's the best rationale.
Yeah, look, time will tell. As we said, if he takes some good early catches and puts a few runs on, gets a half century here or there, he certainly could change things around. In terms of the other guys brought in, the big question is around Sean Marsh. It's his eighth recall to the test team, which, you know, in itself is impressive, but it means you've been axed from the test team seven times. And to be honest, he hasn't lived up to his potential. Tom, he's someone that I'm sure you would have, you know, followed a lot of and seen a lot of and certainly been in and around the cricket conscious over in the UK as well as here. What's your take from the English perspective on Sean Marsh coming into that middle order?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, first thing I'll say is with all the stick England have had about recalling Gary Balance, this is certainly rich of from Australia to recall Sean Marsh now for the eighth time. But I mean, fundamentally, I think I do rate Sean Marsh. I think he's a good player. As I think most Australians will agree, that the Marshes, both of them, take a lot of flack for whatever happens in Australia. And I think the main problem I see with Sean Marsh is his consistency. He's the type of player that will probably go and get 100 in the first game and then get zeros in the rest. It's just typical Sean Marsh. And it's good in the sense in terms of his experience, particularly because, you know, somebody like Tim Payne is going to be coming in next. And at least you know you've got that added experience there at number six. But in terms of has the addition of Sean Marsh kind of filled us with fear? Absolutely not. So I think Australia certainly could have picked better batsmen. Even somebody like Glenn Maxwell, I think would have, in my opinion, probably been a better option. But as we said about Tim Payne, I think time will tell. And absolutely, Sean Marsh has got the potential to be a very good batsman at number six.
I think that the problem there is that we're still talking about Sean Marsh's potential at 34 years of age.
Yeah.
Bo, your take on that?
Yeah, I agree with everything that Tom said. It's interesting to hear an English point of view about Sean Myers, because here he does cop a lot of flack. And I'm actually a little bit of a sympathiser. I know that Dan and I differ on this one. I do rate Sean Marsh as well. I think he's one of our best batsmen, but his test record simply doesn't reflect that. And at a certain point, when do you stop recalling him? Now, eighth test recall, as you say, means seven droppings, but it's not all droppings. One of them was after a century, but then Usman Khawaja was back available and they brought him back in. He was unlucky then. A couple of times was because of injury. So it's not always because of bad form, but I do agree that his form is very up and down, very rocks and diamonds. I do feel for Glenn Maxwell. I feel like these selectors had a real choice to make about the style of batsman they wanted to have at number six. And as I alluded to earlier, I think they really chose someone that was going to be able to marshal that middle order. And as Tom mentions, you know, Tim Payne, Stark and Cummins, a good lower order batsman, and needing someone like a Marsh, like a Ferguson, like a Bailey, who have experience, the ability to rotate, strike, control tempo, was I think a good call. And out of those options, maybe Ferguson deserves it the most on recent form, but Sean Marsh's form in the one-day competition was fantastic. He's hit 350s at 39 in the Shield in three matches, so he's doing pretty well there as well. Glenn Maxwell's probably the most unlucky. He's the incumbent. Showed some decent form in the subcontinent, including 100 in India. So the guy can definitely bat. He's a genuine match winner. He's hit 250s at 40 in the Shield as well with limited opportunities. But I just feel like he's one of those guys that the selectors said, look, we want a type of batsman. We want someone that's got the technique, that's got the temperament that Glenn Maxwell simply doesn't have, despite all of his talent.
I'm not gonna lie, and it's probably come across in my writing, and definitely come across in my Twitter feed. The Marsh brothers bring out the worst in me. I look at them both, and I'm like, I have no reason to dislike you, but my God, do I dislike you? And I'm very open about that. I don't think he should have been picked, as you said. There's guys out there that could certainly feel aggrieved. I've been pretty clear that I probably would have gone with Hilton Cartwright, but Glenn Maxwell's out there. Got guys like George Bailey are still out there scoring runs, and George Bailey just for the nostalgia of smacking Jimmy Anderson for 28 runs in one over. It's almost worth bringing him back for that alone, just to re-demoralise him. But I will say the big winner out of Sean Marsh back in the Test side is the internet. Because memes and comments are just bouncing around the internet at the moment. We certainly flooded our cricket group chat with them yesterday. So there'll be plenty of memes and plenty of chat. I think that's probably the big win. But just sort of looking more broadly at the guys that didn't make it, is there anyone, you know, aside from Glenn Maxwell, you've sort of already covered, Bo, is there anyone else you think maybe is probably a little bit unlucky not to be in the Test side?
Well, we've already talked about Matt Renshaw. Unfortunately for him, he averaged 11 in the Shield so far. He probably deserves some faith, and that's the thing about Matt Renshaw. I mean, you look at a guy like him with his temperament, his skills, his age, he's 20 or 21. He's a guy that could be Australia's next 10,000-run player, you know, Steve Smith aside. So, but this could be the making of him. This could be something that, you know, like every young batsman gets dropped, and some of them come back better if they're good enough. And Matt Renshaw, this could be the making of him. It could take him to that level where he's not averaging 36 anymore. He's averaging 46, like an Alistair Cook.
He's certainly been compared to another big, tall Queensland opener in Matthew Hayden. And we know Haydos suffered, you know, some setbacks early on before he rose to prominence. So, Tom, from an English perspective, it'll be great to see Matt Renshaw scoring big double centuries for the next decade, 15 years against England.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, personally, from a impartial perspective, I would have liked to have seen Matt Renshaw still play. I think he's played incredibly well, and opening at the top of the order isn't easy. And to be to face some of the oppositions he has faced, although albeit different to kind of what he'll face in the Ashes now, or would have faced in the Ashes now, I think he's done incredibly well. And I think, you know, Australia have potentially missed a trick. And similarly with England, I think somebody like Haseeb Hameed, who's quite similar to Renshaw, I think both teams are probably missing a trick in terms of bringing in a player that can last. Because it's a rarity these days to find players that really can go on and face a lot of balls. Because I can remember in the chat not long ago, was it Renshaw that got, I think it was about 17 runs off 110 balls or something like that.
Yep.
Now, it, obviously, part of the part of his job is to score runs, but at the same time, it's also to see off the new ball too. Now, staying there for nearly 20 overs, in my opinion, although he hasn't scored runs, he's still done a very good job in seeing off the new ball. And I think, I'm not sure, I don't know too much about Bancroft and his in the way he is in his style, but in my opinion, it's a rarity to find somebody like that, that can face so many balls and show so much maturity.
I think it's for him, and you said it's the same with Hameed, who's been great. He's Lancashire, isn't he? From Lancashire.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both of those guys place such a high price on their wicket. They value their wicket beyond some easy runs, which someone like David Warner perhaps hasn't done all the time with some rash shots. So we're getting a little bit of background noise there, so I don't know whether Bo's in it. All good. I don't know whether we're having a storm or what's going on, but all good. We can certainly press on through a little bit of sound interference. Just to wrap up on the Australian side of things, overall, the squad, Steve Smith, David Warner, Bancroft, Khawaja, Hanscom, Marsh, Payne, Lyon, Hazelwood, Stark, Cummins, Bird and Sayers. I'm going to assume we're all pretty confident it's going to be Lyon, Hazelwood, Stark and Cummins bowling, and Bird and Sayers going to be carrying the drinks. Bo?
Yes. Yeah, I'd say so. I do feel for Jackson Bird, who's in good form. He's taken 10 wickets this season so far in two matches, and he's always done a good job for Australia. Chad Sayers, perennially overlooked by the selectors, with amazing statistics, especially at Adelaide. But realistically, who do England not want to face the most? And the answer to that is a combination of Stark and Cummins, with Hazelwood doing the grunt work and Lyon turning them sideways. So they have to go with Cummins, in my opinion, at least to set the tone. If injury strikes, I'd like to see Chad Sayers come in next out of Bird and Sayers, but especially given the next games at Adelaide. And this 13-man squad has been named with the two matches in mind. So... should an injury strike, I'd like to see Chad Sayers, but definitely Pat Cummins has the edge at this stage.
Tom, from your perspective, that's probably the bowling lineup you'd least like to see England face: Lyon, Hazelwood, Stark, and Cummins.
Absolutely, yeah. And just to bring back on a point, as Bo just said about this being a two-test squad. In terms of getting your opinion on this, it's something I thought about earlier. But if for instance, I know Australia don't lose at the Gabba, but if for instance, the unthinkable happened and, say, for instance, some of the additions into the squad, i.e. Tim Payne and Cameron Bancroft, did absolutely appallingly, do you think there would be changes for the second test? Or do you think Australia would make changes, bearing in mind that England... already have the Ashes, so they only need to draw the series to take it home, to take the Ashes home.
Yeah, no, I do. I look at the selectors, and I think the Australian selectors right now are very reactionary.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it will be, if we lose at the Gabba, which, as you said, is almost unthinkable, and certainly don't want to tempt fate or anything, but it doesn't feel like it's possible. But as you said, drawing that bow and sort of taking it as a hypothetical, even if it's a draw, if there's some rain or something like that and it peters out to a draw, I think the Australian selectors could make those changes, particularly, as you said, if some of the new guys, if Bancroft or Marsh or Payne, excuse me, potentially don't start with the best foot forward, then I think very quickly they could say, well, look, we tried, we experimented, we failed, throw it out, start again. And I'm not saying that's the right way to go, but I do think that's the way the Australian selectors under Trevor Holmes sort of approach things. There's too many guys that need to prove something, and if they don't, I think they could be pushed out the door pretty quickly.
Yeah. Agreed. So,
So what we might do, we might leave the Australian squad there. We've certainly covered that pretty extensively. We'll have a quick musical interlude. We'll come back and we'll talk about the English side of things. Okay, coming back, we're going to talk a little bit about the tourists on the... I'm not sure they know it yet, the tourists on the verge of a 5-0 whitewash, and I'm certain that it's going to be a painfully long summer for the English, as Richie Beno, under the guise of Billy Birmingham, once said in a famous album, batting was the first of many, many poor decisions this summer for England. And hoping that turns out to be the case again. Tom, in terms of the tour so far, there's been some results already. Obviously, the big stuff yet to come, but some interesting results to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. As Shane Warne said before England even got to Australia, Shane Warne says that England need to make an impact before, throughout the Ashes, and that starts with the warm-up games. And so I think England have... It's not as convincing as they would have wanted it to have been, but I think they'll be happy with the way that things have gone so far. In particular, I think they're happy with the fact that the players that everyone cast doubt over have scored runs, and Alistair Cook and Joe Root not so, although Root has scored and Cook has scored in this most recent game. But I think overall, England will be relatively happy, other than obviously the injury worries they have, but also I know that Mason Crane, for instance, was a bit of a questionable selection, and I think he's actually bowled pretty well, and I was quite nervous beforehand in terms of if Moeen Ali, for instance, was to get injured on the morning of a test, would Mason Crane be able to fill in his shoes, although I don't think he'd maybe be as effective as Moeen Ali, but I certainly think he would be able to hold his own now, and he's shown maturity in the way that he's been bowling over in Australia in the warm-up games.
Now, obviously, Tom, there's been a lot of contention about whether Ben Stokes should have been part of the series. Your take on that drama and his involvement?
Yeah, absolutely. As far as I know, the investigation is still ongoing with Ben. So it seems that until further notice, he's not going to be taking any part in the test matches. I did read that the police were due to make an announcement last week, but it's nothing as surfaced yet. But interestingly, today Ben Stokes is. On his social media has started showing himself in the nets. He's been bowling and he's been batting. It's been in the media that New Balance have essentially sacked him and they're no longer his sponsor, and he's unveiled his new bats on social media. So he's got totally plain bats, but just sponsored by Red Bull now. And I don't know whether that's an indication or a sign of things to come. I know a lot of people have been talking about conspiracy theories that England are doing a Mourinho-esque job and basically saying, oh, Stokes isn't coming, and then they're just going to push him out on the morning of the first test and say, oh, he's here. But yeah, as far as you know, he's not going to be taking any part in the test matches, and I'm just working on the basis that he's not going to play. And if he does, brilliant. If he doesn't, then then we'll just have to deal with it.
Bo, do you think that's the right decision from the English, if in fact that's the way it goes?
Look, the video evidence was pretty damning, obviously. There is some contention about that, as Tom mentions. It's under investigation. I believe that if he did punch that person and there was, you know, very little actual reason to do it, and it's proven that it is indeed him, he should probably be in jail, not an Ashes series. I mean, I know that the English have a history of sending convicts over to Australia, but we probably shouldn't be sending him over if he is found guilty. If he's found not guilty, I'd love to have him over here. I think it would be good bants for a start. The crowd would love it. But apart from that, he's just a world-class all-rounder. And what he does for that team balance, I'm looking at the Ashes squad as we speak, and I don't, like, apart from Moeen Ali, I don't see any other all-rounders in there. And unless you call Chris Wokes an all-rounder, I call him a bowling all-rounder at best. So what he does for team balance in that side, he gives them a fifth bowler and a genuine number five or six bat in a batting lineup that's fairly weak as well. So I'd love to see him. I'd love to see it from a cricket lover's point of view, but I'm just not entirely sure that he deserves it. But time will tell.
Yeah, look, I took the same approach. There's stories that came out sort of after the fact that he was standing up for a gay man or a gay couple that were copping some abuse, but the footage is very damning, and there's absolutely no excuse to go to that level and to that extreme, and there's really no reason to think that that's appropriate behavior, especially from someone who's a role model and a professional athlete. And obviously a lot of the stuff that came out after that, and you know, the KD Price stuff, not the world's worst sort of crimes, if you want to call them that, but just sort of compounded on top of it, and certainly doesn't give him a glowing character reference. So I certainly won't be upset that he's if he doesn't take part on that alone. But as you said, tremendous athlete, tremendous cricketer, and I think he would certainly go a long way toward to boosting England's chances of, you know, maybe drawing one test. No, that was a little bit cruel, wasn't it? That was a little bit cruel. The rain will do that. It rains in Sydney all the time now, doesn't it? So, yeah, overall, I think, you know, it's certainly out of our cricket's hands, or the ECB's hands, with what's going on over there, but I think the right call will be made. In terms of the guys that are in the squad, there's a lot of people that your average Australian cricket fan probably doesn't know. Guys like Jake Ball, Mason Crane's got a little bit of buzz now, and he did play a little bit of domestic cricket out here, so he's got a little bit of an understanding. But Ben Foulkes, Dawid Malan, Craig Overton, Mark Stoneman. Tom, there's a lot of fresh faces in that squad.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jake Ball's had some international experience now. He burst on the scene, I think it was last year. He just took a lot of wickets at the start of the season and almost forced his way into the Test squad. He hasn't really been he hasn't really shown or demonstrated his promise that he initially showed. But you know, it's still there. I mean, personally, I don't think his style will suit Australian conditions. He is a fast bowler, but he's very much a line and length bowler, and he tends to get quite a bit of swing in England. And I think that with Broad and Anderson already probably being the best at bat, I just think it adds, you know, another bowler that's exactly the same. As you say about Mason Crane, he's very young and inexperienced, but he's shown a lot of promise, and he's also had experience in Australia, and I think that's what Trevor Bayliss liked. Craig Overton, now I think he does offer something different. He is more of a pace bowler, and he is quick. And although his batting statistics from the tour so far don't necessarily suggest that, he can actually bat too, and he's quite a powerful batsman down the order, and quite useful for his county. And also Ben Foulkes. Now, I think Ben Foulkes is an incredibly good player, and he will at some point become England's wicketkeeper. I actually think he's probably good enough to bat in his own right as a batsman. Now, I think that Ben's been incredibly lucky not to have played in really any of the tour games, and he probably won't play in any of the test matches either, which I think is a real shame. But yeah, in terms of the players that they've brought in, I've got kind of a mixed opinion on them. But yeah, I think overall, they still have a strong squad, or strong enough squad, shall I say. And the other than maybe Jake Ball, I think that anyone else could fall into the team and do a job for England. I think if the only thing I worry about with Jake Ball is he comes in, and if Broad and Anderson are finding it difficult, I think Jake Ball will find it even more difficult, and will probably go for even more runs than Broad and Anderson. And he just doesn't really offer anything different.
Which does make sense. That's why I think the big thing for Australia is having a Hazelwood that's line length, mm-hmm. Consistency, Stark, Cummins a lot more pace, obviously. Mm-hmm. Those big hooping left-handed Yorkers out of Stark make a huge difference. Looking across the squad, Bo, is there anyone in that English squad that stands out? Who are the key guys that, apart from, say, Joe Root and Alistair Cook, just to change it up a little bit, who are the key guys that you think are going to have to stand up for England to challenge Australia consistently over five tests?
Well, to me, it really depends on the selection choices they make. But I am kind of excited to see what Mark Stoneman has to offer. A lot of people won't realise this, but... I'm a big fan of International Cricket Captain, the video game. So I'm an avid follower of county cricket, at least from afar. And Mark Stoneman has knocked the door down this season, much the same way that Bancroft has in Australia. He let me just find those stats about Stoneman. He scored 450s at 60 in Division 1 for Surrey. So he's the kind of guy that's in form and must play. And as an opener, you know, facing Hazelwood and Stark with a new pill, and then, you know, if he lasts that long, the relief of, you know, Pat Cummins at 145 k's an hour, he is someone that really can make a difference. That means I'll be opening with two left-handers in Stoneman and Cook, who has a really great record in Australia, averaging 49. So I feel like the opening partnership is going to be key, and particularly when you compare it to Australia's, if you know, Bancroft with his inexperience, Warner being fairly unpredictable at the best of times, if England can get the upper hand in terms of, you know, they bat first, get that first session underway, they're none for 80 at lunch, you know, we could be talking about a very different series here. So I think Stoneman is certainly a key player. Gary Balance, we spoke about him earlier when we're talking about Sean Marsh. Again, I rate Gary Balance. And this season for Yorkshire, 300s, 450s at 67 runs per wicket. He's got the class. It's just a matter of, does he have the temperament, the ability, the technique to be able to handle test cricket? He's struggled against Australia in the past. But in order to really shore up that top four, they need Cook, Stoneman, Balance, Root, all firing and all averaging over 40 for the series to have mm-hmm. any chance of springing an upset.
Yeah, look, totally agree. Even you look at Stoneman, before he left England, got some half centuries for Surrey, but 85 against the WA 11, 61 and 51 against the Cricket Australia 11. You'd probably like to see him go on and make those hundreds, but they're good scores there, so it shows that the conditions aren't overwhelming him so much, which will be a huge sign for him. Again, I sort of tend to think a little bit like yourself. It'll be interesting to see the makeup of the squad, for the side for the first test, and where they go. Obviously, you look at guys like Johnny Bairstow, who probably have left a few runs on the table in Australia in the past, who could certainly... if he could play to his potential, and there's that word again we spoke about a lot with some of the Australian guys, then there could certainly be a very different series for himself. And obviously someone like Moeen Ali could play a very key role for England with bat and ball, to be honest with you. Some lower order runs, some spin, which could certainly play a huge role in some of the longer innings, particularly if Australia do happen to go all right. My big question mark is around Jimmy Anderson. He has been, you know, a champion bowler for a long, long time. Australia's probably his final frontier. Yes, he's won tests down here. Yes, he's won series down here with England. But he probably hasn't lived up to his own high standards as an individual player. Tom, is this sort of the time where he finally will do that? Or will he sort of go a little bit unconquered almost?
Yeah, I think he possibly will. I think... Over the last few years, there's been a dip in his performance, I'd say from about 2 years ago up till this year. But I think this year he's really improved. And there's reports saying he was bowling at 90 mile an hour in Australia over the last few weeks, which I think that's converted into kilometres. I think that's about 140 kilometres an hour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for Jimmy Anderson to be doing that, is, you know, shows, I think, firstly, you know, he really wants this. And I think within himself, he knows that this is kind of a final frontier, and this is the last thing that he needs to achieve, is to really dominate in Australia. Obviously, he hasn't quite done that in the past, although he has had individual performances, but he just hasn't been consistent across a whole series. But I'm hoping this series, I think, you know, he really could do, and I know his performances this year have been a lot better on previous years, so fingers crossed, I think he really could do it this year.
In terms of the other bowling cast, obviously you're starting to look at guys like Wokes and Broad. How do you think they'll fall? Well, go one further. The first 11, do you have an idea in your head of what you think the first 11 will be?
Yeah, I think I know what the 11 would be. I think the only question mark before today was who the fourth bowler was going to be, and it's kind of been confirmed that I think it will be Overton. So I think the 11 is going to be Cook, Stoneman, James Vince at 3. Joe Root at 4, Darren Millan at 5, Johnny Bairstow, Moeen Ali, Chris Wokes, Overton, Broad and Anderson. Now, I think, as I said before, Overton really does offer something different. And I think he'll surprise a few of the Australians too, in terms of how fast he is and also his aggression. He's an incredibly aggressive player. He really will get in the faces of the Australians too. And, you know, some of them will like that, some of them won't. But he really will try and get under their skin. He's certainly one that hasn't been shy of controversy throughout his career. He's, you know, he's been suspended from games previously. And I think he really will add what they'll miss from Stokes, for instance. He will really add that in. And to come on to someone like Chris Wokes, I personally think Chris Wokes is probably England's best bowler overseas. I think he was absolutely brilliant in India last year, and he was. And I think since that South African tour, when he went away and he really added some pace, he's bowling essentially 90 mile an hour now, and he's swinging the ball incredibly well. He seems to be swinging the ball better than Anderson at times. So I think he will be the man for England, and I think if England are going to do well, Chris Wokes will be England's best bowler.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree. I think he's certainly the most consistent, whereas someone like Anderson can get... I think someone like Jimmy Anderson is almost so used to having success and picking up wickets that if things get a little difficult, he can get a little erratic and start moving away from the things that he does well. So I certainly think Wokes on his consistency alone will continue to cause issues for Australian batsmen. Yeah. Every time he bowls a ball,
absolutely. Yeah, add as well, not to underestimate his batting either. His first class batting record is actually better than Ben Stokes's, and he averages about 36 for the bat in first class cricket. And for England in the past, he's put in some really key performances I think most notably the one against Sri Lanka last year in the one day game where I think he got about 96 or something like that. So I think he really can, down the order, I think he'll probably be about 8. And he really can kind of add some runs down the order when needed.
If I can just jump in there, then.
Go back.
I'm loving the idea of having, you know, Craig Overton, 23-year-old firebrand from Somerset on debut. I love that idea. I love Wokes. I want to see Anderson do well. Part of me really admires his skills. He's not quite in the top echelon of England's greatest ever fast bowlers, you know, when you think about Barwood and Barnes and Truman, but he's just below that. And with his longevity, his skills, and I certainly wouldn't underestimate that fire in his belly to do well in Australia, like you mentioned before, Dan. One question for Tom, though. You mentioned that you think James Vince will be the number 3 and that Gary Ballance won't make the final 11. Now, I've done some research on Vince, and he's got a fine record in county cricket over his career, but this season for Hampshire, he's only averaged 32, and he's played 7 test matches in his career with no half centuries. So you would prefer to have Vince with that record coming at number 3 compared to, say, Gary Ballance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's two types of people in England, and it's, you either love Gary Ballance or you hate him. I actually really, really like Gary Ballance, but he isn't a number 3, and he never should have played at number 3 for England. He doesn't play there for Yorkshire. It's very rare that he plays there for Yorkshire. He actually plays at 5 for Yorkshire, and in my opinion, that's his best position. Vince, in comparison, I think he's got a far better technique. And, I mean, to quote Michael Vaughan, James Vince is too good a cricketer not to be playing Test cricket. He generally plays his best cricket when he's playing white ball cricket. But if you watch him, he looks very much a Test player when he's playing white ball cricket. And it's really strange to watch, but he's an incredibly... He plays proper shots, and I think Australian pitches will really suit him. I know he hasn't gone on to set the world on fire with in the warm-up games in Australia, but I think he will be a surprise package for England. And I think, although I would personally have Gary Ballance at 5, David Milani, I mean, he scored 100 today, or yesterday in Australian time. He scored 109, and he's also scored a 56, a 63, and a 5. Now, I'm not a massive fan of David Milan in terms of first-class cricket. He's, in my opinion, he's quite unaccomplished, and he doesn't suit the longer format of the game, in my opinion. But he has done really well on the... it seems in the Australian conditions, so I can't see. Well, there isn't any reason that for the selectors to drop him. But I know that as far as I know, Ballance will not play at 3. I think they would probably bring somebody else in before they put Ballance at 3. I think it's just an absolute no go. But it seems that he is earmarked to drop into number 5 if there's a problem. With Milan.
Is there something I'm missing other than the fact that I don't think he wants to bat there?
Yeah.
Why doesn't Joe Root bat at 3? That solves your 3 problem, and it gives you the chance to bring in Ballance at 5.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what Trevor Bayliss has been wanting for a long time. This is what the whole country has wanted. But yeah, Joe Root essentially doesn't want to bat at 3. I've not found a persuasive reason why, and I think it would solve the problem, other than the fact that he probably doesn't want to be facing, you know, balls in probably the first few overs of the game, considering how the opening partnership for England has been over the last year or two, or a few years. But yeah, essentially Joe Root will not bat at 3.
And it seems crazy to me. Just seems like that would be his natural role. But absolutely, obviously, if you don't want to bat there, he doesn't want to bat there, and that's the joy of being the skipper, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Overall, Bo, for the series, just looking ahead, we sort of won't get into the nitty-gritty of all 5 tests, but overall, who do you think go into the series as favourites?
Well, it's one of those sort of things where in Test cricket these days, the home country is generally the winner of the series. And I would say that Australia are certainly the favourites, but I will temper that with the fact that I do feel like the instability in their selections and in terms of the team lineup will affect performance somewhat. It may be a positive effect. You may bring in that fresh blood with something to prove. Tim Payne's been waiting for this opportunity a long time and he's worked super hard to get there. So you better believe that he'll be doing his best to capitalise. But look, I don't know. It just seems a bit unstable for my liking. I prefer my Australian teams to, you know, be like the early 2000s. But hey, can't all have those health sign on days all the time. I would say that Australia are the favourites for the series, though.
Tom, do you agree or do you genuinely think England will be the favourites going in?
In terms of the common opinion, obviously Australia are favourites, and as Bo mentioned, home pitches and home conditions, home teams are generally favourites. But I honestly believe that, and I'm quietly confident that England, I think, will cause an upset. I mean, I think the biggest problem for England is going to be getting past the first test. I think if, I mean, obviously they'd love a win, but I think if they could even just pull off a draw there, this is what Australia have obviously set this up. They wanted the first test at the Gabba. They want to win. They don't lose at the Gabba. And so I think Australia's think, right, if we can get this 1-0 up going into the second game, which is a day-night test, which I think is really going to benefit England, and I'm really confident about that. I think England have got a real chance, and as Bo said, with the instability of the team, I think that only really goes in England's favour, and as underdogs, teams like that underdog status too, because there's absolutely no pressure on them, whereas all the pressure's on Australia.
Yeah, it's certainly hard to disagree with that portion of it. It's certainly going to be a high pressure and a very intense situation for Australia, particularly if it doesn't start well, and that could certainly compound moving forward if things don't pick up. In terms of the first test, from both of you, I'll start with Bo. I just want to get your prediction for the result, and if you've got any bold predictions, anything that sort of is a bit of a hot take, what have you got for me?
I've got the draw. I think Australia are the absolute heavy favourites, no question about it, but I feel like you don't have to look back too far in history for England to find their blueprint for a series victory in Australia, and that started with batting for days at the Gabba. And that was Alistair Cook and Jonathan Trott from memory that just put on amazing amounts of runs. Now, if you're looking at people like Cook and Root, if they can find that form, I think England's mission will be bat. Try and bleed some overs out of Stark and Cummins. Try and make sure that they're not playing in Adelaide. I do believe that's going to be. And that's probably a bold prediction in and of itself. In terms of more individual performances, I would suggest Usman Khawaja will be Australia's top scorer. I feel like he'll score at least 100. He's just in rich form at the moment, averaging 81 in the first three games of the Shield. He's got a point to prove. He's got a wonderful record in Australia. And his lovely cover-driving technique is just perfectly suited to face the swing bowling of Anderson, Broad, Wokes.
It's beautiful to watch, too.
Probably Overton. Yeah, unfortunately, it even looks kind of good when he's edging it to second slip. You know what I mean? Like, it still looks like a good shot, just missed it by a millimetre or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's my bold prediction.
Tom, prediction for the result of the first test and any bold prediction?
I'm probably on a draw too. I think the pitch is going to be pretty flat, and because I traditionally I think Australia produce incredibly flat pitches because they see themselves as, you know, an incredibly strong batting unit with the individual bowlers that have really got something about them, i.e. Mitchell Starc. But I believe that Overton and Wokes will probably pull off a surprise. And I know Moeen Ali, for instance, has had it over on David Warner quite a few times too. The key thing for England is going to be somebody needs to go and get 100 at least. Now, I'm hoping that the way that Mark Stoneman's batting, for instance, he can go on and get some runs, but also then Root and Cook too. Now, yeah, I'm going for a draw in the first match, and I think that's going to cause real problems for Australia. And just to pick up on what Beau just said too, England know that the Australian bowlers are prone to an injury, and this, I think, will also play in England's favour in terms of the series, that if, for instance, Cummins and Starc were to get injured, the in terms of who's favourites then, I think England would look very favourable to potentially pull off an upset at that point. And they know that those two bowlers in particular are prone to injury, so they'll be trying their hardest, I'm sure, to make them bowl as much as they can. In terms of bowl predictions, I personally think Chris Wokes will be the leading wicket taker of the whole series.
Ooh. That's certainly a bold prediction. I won't argue with that.
I like it.
Yeah, it certainly could. I wouldn't rule it out. As confident as I am in Australia, I wouldn't rule it out. For mine, I'm predicting Australia win at the Gabba. It's what happens. It's summer tradition. It's unthinkable for me that's not the case. So I'm going to stick with a win at the Gabba. And my bold prediction for the first test is that Cameron Bancroft will finish the test with a test average in excess of 80. I don't know how he'll get it, but I think he'll score some decent runs. And I think there's a fair chance he's going to go big in at least one innings. So I think he'll have an average of at least 80 by the end of the first test. And it's probably only ever downhill from there, but it'll be a great way to start for him.
That is bold. It's almost as bold as when I said that Kohli would average less than 45 for that Australia versus India series, and he ended up scoring 46 runs total. I should have gone lower.
Well, I don't want to belabor the point. I know I didn't get it right, but I think there was only one person that thought Australia had a chance in that series, and I think I predicted it. But I thought we'd win in India, and I still called out hope that we kind of should have. We threw that away. Anyway, we've gone past the hour mark. We've probably bored people senseless with an hour plus of Ashes talk, but I hate to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, there will be plenty more Ashes talk over the next couple of months. It's going to be huge. The content is going to be churning out on Real Sport, www.realsport101. Today, my guests have been Beau Nicholson and Thomas Slipinzewski, the sub-editor of the cricket section at realsport101.com. Gentlemen, it's both been a pleasure. Before I let you go, Tom, do you have any Twitter you'd like to plug or anything like that?
I can't actually remember my Twitter handle. One second.
While you look it up, Beau, what's your
that
Twitter
handle? That old
chestnut. Yeah.
Beau did this as well.
See, I've also been it. my Twitter handle is Boden, that's Boden underscore Beau. So that covers both of my first names. I prefer Beau, but go with Boden underscore Beau to hear very sporadic, random, inane comments about various things.
Yeah, fish. That's what Twitter's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, my Twitter handle is at Thomas, and then it's SLIPANCZE. I couldn't get my full surname in because it's too long. So, yeah, it's my name, and then it ends at E.
Close enough. Mine at Undiluted7. Don't follow me if you don't like left-wing politics, because we'll probably just get in an argument at some point. But it would be fun, and I do talk plenty of cricket and all sorts of other stuff as well. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me this morning or this evening in England, as the case may be for Thomas.
Thank you.
I'll let you enjoy your Friday night now. Beau and I have our Saturday morning to enjoy here in Australia, and we will leave it at that. Of course, we are here courtesy of Real Sport, realsport101.com. Thank you.